Chapter 9. Safe in the housekeeper's room, Beach sat gazing out of the window at the lowering sky. His chest was still rising and falling like a troubled ocean. Too hot, felt Beach, too hot. Things were becoming too hot altogether. His whole mind was obsessed by an insistent urge to get rid of these papers, the guardianship of which had become so hazardous a matter. The chase was growing too strenuous for a man of regular habits who liked a quiet life. Nearly everything in this world cuts both ways. A fall from a deck chair, for instance, is physically a painful experience. Against its obvious drawbacks, however, must be set the fact that it does render the subject nimbler mentally. It shakes up the brain. To the circumstance of his having so recently come down with a bump on his spacious trouser seat must be attributed the swiftness with which Beach now got an idea that seemed to him to solve everything. He saw the way out. He would hand this manuscript over to Mr. Ronald. There was its logical custodian. Mr. Ronald was the person most interested in its safety. He was, moreover, a young man. And the more he mused on the whole unpleasant affair, the more firmly did Beach come to the conclusion that the foiling of the Parslow gang and the Tilbury gang was young man's work. It would be necessary, of course, to apply to the Honourable Galahad for permission to take the step. If you went behind his back and acted on your own initiative after he had given you instructions, Mr. Galahad could be quite as bad as any gang. Years of association with London's toughest citizens had given him a breadth of vocabulary which was not lightly to be faced. Beach had no intention of drawing upon himself the lightnings of that Pelican Club-trained tongue. As soon as he felt sufficiently restored to move, he went in search of the Honourable Galahad and found him in the small library. Might I speak to you, Mr. Galahad? Say on, Beach. Clearly and well, the butler told his tale. He recounted the scene at the Emsworth Arms, the subsequent invasion of his pantry by the man Bodkin, the proffered bribe. The Honourable Galahad listened with fire smouldering behind his monocle. The young toad, he cried. Monty Bodkin! A fella I've practically nursed in my bosom. Why, I can remember when he was a boy at Eton, taking him aside as he was going back to school one time and urging him to put his shirt on Whistling Rufus for the Cesarevich.
Indeed, sir.
And he notified me subsequently that, thanks to my kindly advice, he'd cleaned up to the extent of 11 shillings, in addition to a bag of bananas, 2 strawberry ice creams, and a 3-cornered Cape of Good Hope stamp at 100 to 16 from a schoolmate who was making a book. And this is how he repays me, said the Honourable Galahad, looking like King Lear. Isn't there such a thing as gratitude in the world? He expressed his disgust with a wide, passionate gesture. The butler, with his nice instinct for class distinctions, expressed his with one a little less wide and not quite so passionate. These calisthenics seemed to relieve them both, for when the conversation was resumed, it was on a calmer note. I might have known, said the Honourable Galahad, that a fellow like Stinker Pike... What does he call himself now, Beach?
Lord Tilbury, Mr. Galahad.
I might have known that a fellow like Lord Tilbury wouldn't give up the struggle after one rebuff. You don't make a large fortune by knuckling under to rebuffs, Beach.
Very true, Mr. Galahad.
I suppose old Stinker had been up against this sort of thing before. He knows the procedure. The first thing he would do after I'd turned him down would be to set spies and agents to work. Well, I don't see what there is to be done except employ renewed vigilance, like Clarence with his pig.
Beach coughed. I was thinking, Mr. Galahad, that if I were to hand the documents over to Mr. Ronald...
You think that would be safer?
Considerably safer, sir. Now that Mr. Pilbeam is aware that they are in my possession, I am momentarily apprehensive lest her ladyship approach me with a direct request that I deliver them into her hands.
Beach, are you afraid of my sister Constance?
Yes, sir. The Honourable Galahad reflected.
Well, I see what you mean. It would be difficult for you. You couldn't very well tell her to go and put her head in a bag.
No, sir.
All right, then. Give the thing to Mr. Ronald.
Thank you very much, Mr. Galahad.
Infinitely relieved, Beach allowed his gaze, hitherto concentrated on his companion, to travel to the window.
The storm looks like breaking at last, sir.
Yes.
The Honourable Galahad also looked out of the window. It was plain that nature, in all her awful majesty, was about to let herself go. On the opposite side of the valley, there shot jaggedly across the sky a flash of lightning. Thunder growled, and raindrops began to splash against the pane. "That fool's going to get wet," he said. Beach followed his pointing finger. Into the scene below, a figure had come, walking rapidly. His interview with Percy Pilbeam had left Monty in that exhilarating frame of mind which demands strenuous exercise. Where Lord Tilbury, on a previous occasion, had walked because his heart was heavy, Monty walked because his heart was light. Pilbeam had filled him with the utmost confidence. He didn't know how or when, but he felt that Pilbeam would find a way. So now he strode briskly across the park, regardless of the fact that the weather was uncertain. "Mr. Bodkin, sir."
"So it is, that young reptile. He'll get soaked."
"Yes, sir." There was quiet satisfaction in the butler's voice. It was even possible, he was reflecting, that this young man might be struck by lightning. If so, it was all right with Beach. As far as he was concerned, nature's awful majesty could go the limit. He only wished that Pilbeam, too, were being exposed to the fury of the elements. He viewed members of gangs in rather an Old Testament spirit and believed in their getting treated rough. Ronnie was in his bedroom. When the heart is aching, there are few better refuges than a country house bedroom. A man may smoke and think there, undisturbed. Beach, tracking him down a few minutes later, found him well disposed to the arrangements he'd come to suggest. He made no difficulties about accepting custody of the manuscript. Indeed, it seemed to Beach that he was scarcely interested. Listless was the word that occurred to the butler, and he put it down to the weather. He took his departure with feelings resembling those of the man who got rid of the bottle imp, and Ronnie, having thrown the manuscript into a drawer, resumed his seat and began thinking of Sue once more. Sue. It wasn't that he blamed her. If she loved Monty Bodkin, well, that was that. You couldn't blame a girl for preferring one fellow to another. All that stuff his mother had been saying about her being the typical chorus girl fluttering from affair to affair was, of course, just a lot of pernicious bilge. Sue wasn't like that. She was as straight as they make 'em. It was simply that she'd been dazzled by this blasted lissom Monty and couldn't help herself. You were always reading about that sort of thing in novels. Girl gets engaged to bloke, thinking at the moment that he is what the doctor ordered, then runs into second bloke and discovers in a sort of flash that she's picked the wrong one. No doubt on that trip of hers to London, she'd happened to meet Monty accidentally in Piccadilly or somewhere, and the thing had come on her like a thunderbolt. It was what he had been expecting all along, of course. He had told her so himself. It stood to reason, he meant, that a terrific girl like her, a girl who practically stood alone, as you might say, was bound, sooner or later, to come across someone capable of cutting out a bally pink-faced midget who, except for getting a featherweight boxing blue at Cambridge, had never done a thing to justify his existence. Yes, that was about what it all boiled down to, felt Ronnie. He rose and went to the window. For some time now, in a subconscious sort of way, he'd been dimly aware that there was something rummy going on outside. He found himself looking out upon a changed world. The storm was now at its height. Torrents of rain were coursing down the glass. Thunder was booming, lightning flashing. A hissing, howling, roaring, devastated world. A world that seemed to fit in neatly with his stormy emotions. Sue. Yesterday, on the roof, finding that hat and realizing that she and Monty had been up there together all the afternoon, he flattered himself that she couldn't possibly have detected anything from his manner. No, he'd worn the good old mask all right, but there'd been a moment before he'd got hold of himself, when he had understood how those chaps you read about in the papers who run amok and slay two get that way. Yes, reason might tell him that it was perfectly natural for Sue to be in love with Monty Bodkin, but nothing was going to make him like it. The storm seemed to be conking out a bit. The thunder had rolled away into the distance. The lightning flashes had lost much of their zip. Even the rain showed a disposition to cheese it. What had been a Niagara was now little more than a drizzle. And suddenly, watery and faint, there gleamed on the drenched stone of the terrace a ray of sunshine. It grew. Blue spread over the sky. Across the valley there was a rainbow. Ronnie opened the window, and a wave of cool, sweet-smelling air poured into the room. He leant out, sniffing. and abruptly he became aware that the heavy depression of the last 2 days had left him. The thunderstorm had wrought its customary miracle. He felt like a man recovered from a fever. It was as if the whole world had suddenly been purged of gloom. A magic change had come over everything. Birds were singing in the shrubberies below, and for tuppence Ronnie could have sung himself. Why, dash it, he felt, he'd been making a fat-headed fuss about absolutely nothing. He saw it all now. What had given him that extraordinary notion that Sue was in love with Monty was simply the foul weather. Of course, there was nothing between them, really. That lunch could easily be explained. So could that afternoon together on the roof. Everything could easily be explained in this best of all possible worlds. And scarcely had he reached this conclusion when he perceived on the drive below him a draggled figure. It was Monty Bodkin, home from his ramble. He leant further out of the window, overflowing with the milk of human kindness.
"Hello,"
he said. Monty looked up.
"Hello. You're wet."
"Yes."
"By Jove, you are wet," said Ronnie.
It hurt him to think that this brave new world could contain a fellow human being in such a soluble condition.
"You better go and change."
"Yes."
"Into something dry."
Monty nodded, scattering water like a public fountain. He brushed the tangle of hair out of his eyes and squelched on his way. It was perhaps 2 minutes later that Ronnie, still aching with compassion, remembered that on the shelf above his washstand he had a bottle of excellent embrocation. When once a man has reacted from a mood of abysmal depression, there is no knowing how far he will go in the opposite direction. In a normal frame of mind, Ronnie would probably have dismissed the moistness of Monty from his thoughts as soon as the other had left him. But now, in the grip of this strange feeling of universal benevolence, he felt that those few words of sympathy had not been enough. He wanted to do something practical, something constructive that could help to ward off the nasty cold in the head which this man might so easily catch as a result of his total immersion. And as we say, he remembered that bottle of embrocation. It was Riggs Golden Balm, in the large, or 7 and 6 penny size, and he knew, not only from the advertisements, which were very frank about it, but also from personal trial, that it communicated an immediate warm glow to the entire system, averting catarrh, chills, rheumatism, sciatica, stiffness of the joints, and lumbago, and in addition imparted a delightful sensation of bien-être, toning up and renovating the muscular tissues. And if ever a fellow stood in need of warm glows and tonings up, it was Monty. Seizing the bottle, he hurried off on his errand of mercy. He found Monty in his room, stripped to the waist, rubbing himself vigorously with a rough towel.
"I say," he said, "I don't know if you know this stuff. You might like to try it. It communicates a warm glow."
Monty, the towel draped about him like a shawl, examined the bottle with interest. He sloshed it tentatively. This consideration touched him.
"Dash good of you."
"Not a bit."
"You're sure it's not for horses?"
"Horses?
Well, some of these embrocations are. You rub them well in, and then you take another look at the directions, and you see for horses only, or words to that effect, and then you suffer the tortures of the dam for about half an hour, feeling as if you had been having a dip in vitriol." "Oh, no. This stuff's all right. I use it myself." "Then have at it," said Monty, relieved.
He poured some of the fluid into the palm of his hand and expanded his torso, and as he did so, Ronnie Fish uttered a quick, sharp exclamation. Monty looked up, surprised. His benefactor had turned a vivid vermilion and was staring at him in a marked manner.
"Eh?"
he said, puzzled. Ronnie did not speak immediately. He appeared to be engaged in swallowing some hard, jagged substance.
"On your chest,"
he said at length in a strange, toneless voice.
"Eh?"
Eton and Cambridge came to Ronnie's aid. Outwardly calm, he swallowed again, picked a piece of fluff off his left sleeve, and cleared his throat.
"There's something on your chest."
He paused.
"It looks like Sue."
He paused again.
"Sue,"
he said casually,
"with a heart round it."
The hard, jagged substance seemed to have transferred itself to Monty's throat. There was a brief silence while he disposed of it. He was blaming himself. Rummy, he reflected ruefully, how when you saw a thing day after day for a couple of years or so, it ceased to make any impression on what you rather fancied was called the retina. This heart-encircled Sue, this pink and ultramarine tribute to a long-vanished love, which in a gush of romantic fervor he'd caused to be graven in his skin in the early days of their engagement, might during the last 18 months just as well not have been there for all the notice he'd taken of it, and he had practically forgotten that it was still in existence. It was a moment for quick thinking.
Not Sue, he said. S-U-E. Sarah Ursula Ebbsmith. What? Sarah Ursula Ebbsmith, repeated Monte firmly. Girl I used to be engaged to. She died. Pneumonia. Very sad. Don't let's talk of it.
There was a long pause. Ronnie moved to the door. His feelings were almost too deep for words, but he managed a couple.
Well, bungo!
The door closed behind him. Sue had watched the storm from the broad window seat of the library. Her feelings were mixed. As a spectacle, she enjoyed it, for she was fond of thunderstorms. The only thing that spoiled it for her was the knowledge that Monty was out in it. She had seen him crossing the terrace in an outward-bound direction, just as it began to break. The poor lamb, she felt, must be getting soaked. Her first act, accordingly, when the rain stopped and that sea of blue began to spread itself over the sky, was to go out onto the balcony and scan the horizon, like Sister Anne, for signs of him. She was thus enabled to witness his return and to hear the brief exchange of remarks between him and Ronnie.
Hello! Hello! You're wet!
Yes.
By Jove, you are wet. You'd better go and change.
Yes.
Into something dry.
Considered as dialogue, not perhaps on the highest level, reading it through, one sees that it lacks a certain something. But the noblest effort of a great dramatist could not have stirred Sue more. It seemed to her, as she listened, that a great weight had rolled off her heart. It was the way Ronnie had spoken that impressed and thrilled, the kindly, considerate tone, the cheerful cordiality. For 2 days it had been as though some sullen changeling had taken his place, and now, if one could judge from the genial ring of his voice, the old Ronnie was back again. She stood on the balcony, drinking in the fragrant air. It was astonishing what a change that healing storm had brought about. Shropshire, which yesterday had been so depressing a spectacle, was now an earthly paradise. The lake glittered, the river shone, the spinneys were their friendly selves again. Rabbits were darting about in the park with all the old carefree abandon, and as far as the eye could see, they were contented cows. She left the room, humming a little tune. Eventually, she would seek out Monty and make inquiries after his well-being, but her immediate desire was to find Ronnie. The click of billiard balls arrested her attention as she came to the foot of the stairs. Galley, probably, playing a solitary 100 up, but he might be able to tell her where Ronnie was. His voice, during that conversation with Monty, had seemed to come from one of the passage windows. She opened the door, and Ronnie, sprawled over the table, looked up at her. That tattoo mark had settled things for Ronnie. It had swept away in an instant all the gay optimism brought by the passing of the storm. With a heart like lead, he'd groped his way downstairs. The open door of the billiard room had seemed to offer a means of diverting his thoughts temporarily, and he had gone in and begun to practice somber canons. For even if a man is leaden-hearted, there is no harm in his brushing up his near-the-cushion game a bit. Indeed, it's an intelligent thing to do, for if the girl he loves loves another, his life is obviously going to be pretty much of a blank for the next 50 years or so, and he'll have to fall back for solace on his ambitions. One of Ronnie's ambitions was some day to make a flukeless break of 30.
Hello,
he said politely, straightening himself and standing with cue at rest. Eton and Cambridge stood at his elbow to help him through his ordeal. No sense of impending disaster came to Sue. To her, this man was still the sort of modern, cheerable brother whom she had heard chatting so gaily out of the window.
"Oh, Ronnie," she said, "you can't stay indoors on an evening like this. It's simply lovely out."
"Oh, yes," said Eton.
"Perfectly wonderful."
"Oh, yes," said Cambridge.
Something seemed to stab at Sue's heart. Her eyes widened. A numbing thought had begun to frame itself. Could it be that that sunny geniality that she had so recently observed playing upon Monty Bodkin like a fountain was to be withheld from her? But she persevered.
Let's go for a drive in your car.
I don't think I will, thanks.
Then let's take a boat out on the lake.
Not for me, thanks.
Or the court might be dry enough for tennis by now.
I shouldn't think so.
Well then, come for a walk.
Oh, for God's sake, said Ronnie. Let me alone.
They stared at one another. Ronnie's eyes were hot and miserable, but they did not look hot and miserable to Sue. She read in them only the dislike, the sullen, trapped dislike of a man tied to a girl for whom he has ceased to feel any affection, so that merely to speak to her is an affliction to his nerves. She drew a deep breath and walked to the window.
Sorry, said Ronnie gruffly. Shouldn't have said that.
I'm glad you did, said Sue. It's better to come right out with these things. She traced little circles with her finger on the glass. A heavy silence filled the room.
I think we might as well chuck it, don't you? She said.
Just as you say, said Ronnie.
All right, said Sue.
She moved to the door. He hurried forward and opened it for her, polite to the last. Up in his bedroom, meanwhile, anointing his chest with Riggs' golden balm, Monty Bodkin has suddenly become amazingly cheerful. Tiddly-om-pom-pom, he chanted as blithely as any thrush in the shrubbery below. A great idea had just come to him. It was the embrocation that had done the trick. As he stood there enjoying the immediate warm glow and the delightful sensation of bien-être, it was as if his brain, as well as his muscular tissues, had been toned up and renovated. This bottle of embrocation, it suddenly occurred to him, was more than a mere 3 or 4 fluid ounces of stuff that smelled like a miasmic swamp. It was a symbol. If Ronnie was taking the trouble to bring him bottles of embrocation, it must mean that all was well between them. That odd coldness had ceased to be, that his dear old pal, in a word, was once more a dear old pal. And if a man is a dear old pal, it stands to reason that he will be delighted to do a fellow a good turn. The good turn Monty wanted Ronnie to do for him now was to go to Beach and use his influence with that obdurate butler to persuade him to cough up that manuscript. It was not that Monty had lost faith in Pilbeam. No doubt, if given time, Pilbeam, exercising his subtle craft, would be able to secure the thing all right. But why go to all that trouble when you could take a shortcut and work the wheeze quite simply without any fuss? Besides, there was the fellow's fee to be considered. These sleuths probably came pretty high, and a penny saved is a penny earned. A room-to-room search brought him to where the last of the fishes was once more practicing cannons. He approached him with all the happy confidence of a child entering the presence of a rich and indulgent uncle. For Monty Bodkin was no mind reader. He had detected no change in his friend's manner at the end of their recent interview. It had been awkward for a moment, no doubt, that business of the tattoo mark, but he felt that his quick thinking had passed off a tricky situation pretty neatly, satisfactorily lulling all possible suspicions.
"I say, Ronnie, old lad," he said, "I wonder if you would spare a few moments of your valuable time."
Ronnie laid the cue down carefully. For all that he had now resigned himself to the fact that Sue preferred this man to him, he was conscious of a well-defined desire to bat him over the head with the butt end. White-hot knives were gashing Ronnie Fish's soul, and he could not but feel a very vivid distaste for the man responsible for his raw misery.
"Well,"
he said.
It seemed to Monty that his friend was a bit on the chilly side, not quite the effervescing chum of the dear old embrocation days, but he carried on with only a momentary twinge of concern.
"Tell me, old man, how do you stand with Beach?"
"With Beach? How do you mean?"
"Well, does he feel pretty feudal where you're concerned? Would he, in fine, be inclined to stretch a point to oblige the young master?"
Ronnie stared bleakly. He had been prepared to be civil to this man who had wrecked his life, but he was dashed if he was going to spend the evening listening to him talking drip.
"What is all this bilge?" he demanded sourly. "Come to the point."
"Oh, I'm coming to the point. Well, be quick."
"I will, I will. Here, then, is the gist, or nub. Beach has got something I badly want, and he refuses to disgorge. And I thought that perhaps if you went to him and did the young squire bit, exerting your influence, I mean to say, and rather throwing your weight about generally, he might prove more... what's the word? Begins with A. Amenable."
Ronnie glowered wearily.
"I can't understand a damn thing you're talking about."
"Well, in a nutshell, Beach has got that book of old Galley's, and I can't get him to let me have it."
"Why do you want it?"
Monty decided, as he had done when talking with Lord Tilbury by the potting shed, that manly frankness was the only policy.
You know all about that book?
Yes.
That Galley won't let it be published, I mean?
Yes.
And that he had signed a contract for it with the Mammoth Publishing Company?
No, I didn't know that.
Well, he did. And his backing out has rendered poor old Pop Tilbury, the boss of Same, as sick as mud.
Well, naturally, I mean to say, old Tilbury had got serial rights and book rights and American rights and every other kind of rights, including the Scandinavian. And you know what a packet there is in any literary effort that really dishes the dirt about the Blue Gourd. I should say, taking it one way and another, he stands to lose in the neighbourhood of 20,000 quid if Galley sticks to his resolve not to publish. And so, to cut a long story ass, old man, this Tilbury is so anxious to get hold of the manuscript that he states specifically that if I can snitch it from him, he will take me back into his employment, from which, as I dare say you know, I was recently booted out.
I thought you resigned.
Monty smiled sadly.
That may be the story going round the clubs, he said, but as a matter of fact, I was booted out. There was a spot of technical trouble which wouldn't interest you and into which I will not go. Suffice it to say that we did not see eye to eye as regarded the conduct of the Uncle Woggly to his chicks department, and my services were dispensed with. So, now you get the run of the scenario. The thing is a straight issue. Let me grab this MS and turn it into the big chief, and I start working again at Tilbury House.
What do you want to do that for?
It's imperative. I must have a job.
I should have thought that you could have been happy enough here.
Ah, but I'm liable to get the sack here at any moment.
Too bad.
Quite bad enough, agreed Monty. But it'll be all right if you can induce Beach to give up that manuscript. I shall then secure a long-term contract with old Tilbury and be in a position to marry the girl I love.
A strong convulsion shook Ronnie Fish. This, he considered, was pretty raw. A nice thing taking a fella's girl away from him and then coming in to ask him to help him to marry her. He credited the other with more delicacy.
You will, eh?
He said, after a pause to master his emotion.
Positively. It's all fixed up.
Who is she? Asked Ronnie sardonically. Sarah Ursula Ebbsmith?
Eh?
Oh, ah,
said Monty hastily. He'd forgotten for the moment. No, not poor dear Sarah. No. She's dead. Tuberculosis.
They're sad. You told me it was pneumonia.
No, tuberculosis.
I see.
This is a new one. Girl named Gertrude Butterwick.
Misunderstandings being always unfortunate, it was a pity, firstly, that Monty should have paused for a reverent second before uttering that sacred name, and secondly, that the girl of his dreams should have possessed a name which, one has to admit, sounded a little thin. In certain moods, a man whose mind is biased simply does not believe that there is such a name as Gertrude Butterwick. To Ronnie, noting that second's hesitation, it was just one this man had made up on the spur of the moment, even he not having the face to tell Sue's fiancé, as he supposed him still to be, that he wanted his assistance in taking Sue from him.
Gertrude Butterwick, eh?
That's right.
Fond of her?
My dear chap,
and I suppose she's crazy about you.
Oh, deeply enamoured.
Ronnie felt suddenly listless.
What, he asked himself, did it matter anyway? What did anything matter now?
Every man is tempted at times by the great gesture. This temptation had just come overwhelmingly upon Ronnie Fish. From the other's words, he had become confirmed in his suspicion that somehow or other, Monty, since their last meeting, must have lost all his money. Otherwise, why should jobs at Tilbury House be of such importance to him? Unless he got that job at Tilbury House, he would not be able to marry Sue, and unless he, Ronnie Fish, helped him, he would not get it. The Sidney Carton spirit descended upon Ronnie, with this difference, that where Sidney, if one remembers correctly, was rather pleased about the whole thing, he himself felt bitter and defiant. Monty had taken Sue from him. Sue had gone to Monty without a pang. All right, then? All jolly right. He would show them he didn't care. He would let them see the stuff fishes were made of.
Listen, he said. There's no need to worry about Beach. He hasn't got that manuscript.
Oh, yes, he has. I saw him reading.
He gave it to me, said Ronnie.
He picked up his cue and shaped at the spot ball.
You'll find it in the chest of drawers in my room. Take the damn thing if you want it.
Monty gasped. No Israelite, caught in a sudden manna shower in mid-desert, could have felt a greater mixture of surprise and gratification.
My dear old man, he began effusively.
Ronnie did not speak. He was practicing cannons.